This is a Submedia production.
Hello, and welcome to Circle A. I'm your host, JR. For this episode, despite being so incredibly sick of talking about Donald Trump, we're going to take one last parting look at the so-called Capitol Hill riot that occurred less than a week into 2021. We were lucky enough to sit down with Sima Lee, an anarchist MC extraordinaire, member of the Maroon Movement and the Food, Clothing, and Resistance Collective, as well as a fellow Channel Zero podcast host. If you haven't heard her show, Maroon Cast, you should seriously consider making whatever series of mouse clicks or finger taps you need to go and subscribe right now. Seriously, just press pause and come back when you're done. To start things off, we asked Sima to give her general take on everything that unfolded at the US Capitol building on January 6, 2021.
Basically, it was really something that we saw coming, and actually were just surprised that it took so long to manifest. I basically watched the entire thing, and while keeping track of comrades who, you know, are still in D.C., because we've been D.C.-based for so long, you know, that a lot of our comrades are in D.C. or Virginia, as well as here in Baltimore, but you know, we have ties to there. We were there for almost 10 years. And so we're worried as we're watching what's going on at the Capitol. We're always worried about the community and how is this going to have repercussions on the community and radical organizers and people who are unhoused and so on and so forth. But my initial take was, oh, shit. So they're going for it, huh? And by that meaning certain people who aren't happy with the traditional steps of current liberal white supremacy as it's about to be turned over to a more liberal, neoliberal leadership, they're pissed. The whole point of MAGA in the original MAGA of Ronald Reagan was, you know, white supremacy, white nationalism, Christian-based supremacy. And this has been bubbling for so long. These clashes, especially in Washington, D.C., in the streets of Washington, D.C., but across the country, we watch these groups spring up, these continuations of, you know, I'm from Virginia, so this is a continuation of the Confederacy. I mean, we saw the Confederate flags out there. We saw the three percenters out there. We saw the Patriot, you know, boys out there and on and on and on. Like, there were some of the same faces that we've been seeing, some of them for decades. And so, this isn't a shocker. And we know they don't give a damn about the police. We know they did that to antagonize us. So it was no surprise to us that they would clash with the police or anyone else to get their point across, that they're trying to take it back to, you know, the good old days. They brought that gallows and that noose, and it said more about how they feel about us, I feel, more so than those politicians. And so we watched it like, okay, we've been waiting to see them come out and say who they really are as a group collectively and take a stand. And so there they did it. And it is what it is. Fash taking on fash. Us as anti-fascists, we step back, we watch that shit, and we prepare what we have to do for our communities.
Along with the initially underwhelming police presence on January 6th, stories of cops opening gates for the Capitol Hill rioters and literally posing for selfies have made their way across social media. But rather than being isolated incidents, these anecdotes speak to the broader underlying disparity between how police treat black and brown bodies versus how they treat even an armed white mob. Just a heads up, in this next segment, Sima talks about police brutality and other white supremacist violence, as well as the impact it has on people's bodies. Far from focusing on this violence as some kind of victimization narrative, she uses it to contextualize the courage and power of the communities that are fighting back. If you're not in a place to hear descriptions of violence right now, I encourage you to skip ahead about 4 minutes and continue with the rest of Sima's perspective and analysis.
Yeah, we never had any light-hearted interactions with the police. It was always heavy-handed, abusive, pretty much what people have been seeing all spring and all summer. I came at the tail end of Occupy movement, and you know, Occupy DC was violently evicted from, you know, where they were at, and the parks that they were occupying. And you know, a lot of those comrades would be comrades that I would end up living with, and you know, they were beaten and I mean, beaten badly and pepper sprayed. And you know, a lot of those comrades are the same comrades who have been out there all spring and all summer. Their reaction, I mean, anybody who's been paying attention these last few months, you've seen the heavy handedness of the state against anyone. You don't even have to damage buildings, as a lot of people like to say, well, this is about property damage and protecting property, which is meaningless to us, you know, over human life. When we're talking about human life, you're worried about property. You know, a lot of people weren't even bothering property. They were just taking their ability to gather with their own communities to speak about what they wanted. And they were beaten, you know, and had chunks of their foreheads knocked out. There's a whole groups of people now without eyes. We watched several weeks before they came to the Capitol for this last rally. We watched as they rampaged through DC, threatening people, beating journalists, stabbing, you know, stabbing people who are passersby, harassing people, punching people in the face, burning Black Lives Matter flag. I mean, this is, people don't want to call them terrorists because terrorism has been a racialized thing. But you give me a term to call what's going on. This is what our communities have had to deal with for a very long time. And when that type of anger and that hatred got unleashed on these politicians, then it became something where everyone got upset. But we've been having to deal with not just the so-called white supremacists, but the white supremacists of the police department as well. And even the National Guard, like, it has been an attack against the movement, not just so-called Black Lives Matter movement, because all Black people don't identify with that term or that movement, but a Black liberation movement, a movement for land back and autonomy. It's been under attack in Washington, D.C. in particular. If you've watched and paid attention, there's been nothing but so many munitions dumped, so much tear gas. We don't know the long-term effects this is going to have on our comrades. And so to see them be so gentle and kind and considerate, it just highlights what we've been saying all along. It didn't make us feel a certain way other than, yeah, it acknowledged what we've been saying all along, that the police state is the implementation of white nationalism and white supremacy. And it doesn't matter if it's a Black cop, a brown cop. You know, we learned that years ago from KRS-One. All police, they're all in it together with the citizens. And we're seeing from this D.C. situation, D.C. citizens got a great eyeful. And I know more than anybody, they were very upset that their words have been crushed, you know, with billy clubs and arrests and bloody mouths, while people who have come with objectives to basically just fuck shit up, you know, have been given just, you know, a gentle touch. But we're in a serious state of all the contradictions of a 400-year empire is coming to head. And it's coming to head right in the nation's capital, right in Rome. It makes sense. It makes all of this makes perfect sense if anyone's been paying attention.
Though we've said this on our show before, it's worth repeating. Donald Trump was not just another politician. It is fully understandable that getting him out of power would become a focal point for many organizers across the U.S., even those who wouldn't normally spend their energies on such endeavors. Those of us who live elsewhere and haven't experienced a government sustained by overtly racist populism need to be especially careful in our critiques. With that said, Joe Biden is a monster sitting atop a pile of corpses. He has done more, even than most other American politicians, to construct and reinforce the prison industrial complex and to promote the continuation of U.S. military aggression in the Middle East. His posturing as an ally of marginalized communities is the most sickening form of opportunism, and the list of atrocities resulting from his presidency will be a long one.
I feel like this incident has told on people, or I should say that people are telling on themselves. People are showing their own liberalism. You know, I expect the liberals to be, you know, flag waving, you know, my country, my flag, my people, my capital, my politicians. You know, I expect that from liberals. And I don't give a damn how liberals or, you know, my job isn't to analyze how liberals take things or how conservatives take things. I'm looking at how, you know, so-called leftists are repeating the words of the state, are looking for help from feds who have been crushing us. My comrades have been getting visits, you know, at their jobs, at their homes, snatched out of their cars. You know, we know what it feels like to get raided by the Metropolitan Police Department with guns and dogs. We know what that feels like. I know what that feels like to have an AR in my face in a house full of police, to be watched and observed in different states, to have friends blackbagged and kidnapped from Chicago to Virginia. This is real. And so my comrades aren't reacting in that manner, but other people that I know and I'm affiliated with, I'm seeing people not being able to accept that we're not going to get any real assistance from our actual enemies, you know, in dealing with our actual enemies. It's like, you know, the old thing, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, that's bullshit. The fascist state is not ever going to be my friend. And people's reactions, you know, they're trying to use this as propaganda. They would use the black cop who, you know, ran through the building and diverted people away from the politicians. I don't, you know, look, these politicians, the Democrats and the Republicans both have sat for 4 years on their hands as Trump has gutted and took away so many rights that people have fought in the streets for. They sat for, you know, for a whole year as people were starving and getting evicted, and 350,000 plus people died from something that could have been handled so much better. You know, they sat and they did nothing. And for people to claim these people in the Capitol as if they represent anything other than the elite and that they care about us, it bothers me, it disturbs me. It's like, what are we doing? What have we been fighting for? What have we been screaming about for years? You know, everybody that was out there, we had clashed with, you know, and from the NPI, when Richard Spencer would come here, you know, before he was a meme, he would, you know, come through Washington, D.C., and we would do what we needed to do. Matthew Heimbach, when he was with the Towson White Student Union, clashes. My comrades got their faces split, and we've been followed by the Secret Service after participating in protests in Washington, D.C. We've been followed by feds. You know, people's reaction to white supremacists gathering at the home of white supremacy, clashing with each other, it's just been really odd, and it's been off. You know, people are talking about abolitionism. That's not just about abolishing prison. It's about abolishing the entire state, the entire apparatus, the entire empire. It has to go. So some people are like, well, what are you saying? You don't want Fash to go to jail? Aren't we trying to eradicate all of this? All of it. We're trying to eradicate all of it. We're going to have to find out what we're going to do with the people who are making our lives so horrible. centuries of this white supremacist white nationalist violence. But I could tell you what we're not going to do is start dealing with the feds, who have helped, been the biggest, protectors of white nationalism. Like, people can quote Asada and still love the feds when they're after her again. You could quote the same people who killed like 30 plus Panthers. Sundiata Okolie is still in jail right now and celebrating his birthday and Maroon and Mutulu and on and on and on. Like, we don't cheer the feds. We don't work with the feds. When we spread information about these fascists, we spread it amongst us. We're the resistance. We're the guerrillas. We take care of our communities and we protect them. We keep them from coming in our communities. No pasará. Because our anti-fascism is old, especially for us. It goes way back. So we don't work with the feds. We don't cheer on the feds. We don't cheer on new laws that will be used against our communities. They don't need laws to attack our communities, but they continue to make new laws that will make it even easier for them. And they will pretend that it's going to go against the white supremacists, and it always goes against us. So it's disheartening to see people debating, you know, what to call this and what is this? It wasn't really an insurgency. It was just a minor. It was what it was. It's what it has been for 400 years. Sometimes they clash amongst each other, the elite, the white supremacists, the foot soldiers. But it always blows back against us. We can never cheer them on, ever. And it's just kind of disappointing. And it seems like, I don't know what's going on with the left in North America, but they really need to get it together. And they need to reanalyze what they feel abolition and autonomy really is, because it's definitely not cheering on the state.
Focusing on street brawls gives a distorted view of anti-fascist organizing, but it can also misrepresent the context of white supremacist mobilization. In the United States, racialized communities aren't just dealing with the fringe enthusiasts who slap on combat fatigues or black and gold Fred Perry polos to go shout white power. These blatant manifestations are merely the tip of the racist iceberg, and the growth in their numbers is accompanied by a proportional increase in the much broader population that supports their ideas. This results in a whole lot more anti-fascist work than simply showing up at a convergence ready to battle. The situation requires a sustained counterforce, which all too often falls entirely on targeted community members, even those who want nothing to do with political organizing whatsoever.
I know my comrades are doing the best that they can, but, you know, when you see the amount of people that were out in the streets to celebrate the next emperor, Biden, you know, the same person who wrote the crime bill that caused mass incarceration to go up 700%, you know, everybody was dancing in the street, you know, and popping bottles and having a good time. When it came to the Proud Boys doing their dry runs and beating the shit out of black and brown people and anti-racist white people, the numbers out there were not the same. And it really should have been a larger amount of anti-fascist people out there countering what they were doing, self-defense and offense. I don't have any qualms about saying that these motherfuckers need their asses beat. And, you know, straight like that. Like, I'm not a turn the other cheek, nonviolent type of person. Like, you're traveling from multiple states away to come and terrorize black, brown, indigenous people, to terrorize, you know, young student, anti-racist white people who are actively stepping away and jumping off the pedestal of their privilege, some of them, and putting themselves on the line and who can do that with small numbers when you have such a mass amount of people? So people were getting left alone, you know, cornered, beaten, just everything you're not supposed to do when you're out there. It is a serious situation to deal with fascists. You know, people can go on YouTube and feel all giddy looking at videos of clashes, and, you know, it looks exciting, right? But those things don't just happen. And it's not just about the excitement. It isn't a LARP. You know, this isn't a role playing game. We're not dressing up in cosplay. This is serious. And sometimes I question how serious some of the people are on the ground. I know for the Black, Brown, Indigenous people who were in the communities of D.C., this is just, you know, we're just trying to protect ourselves in our neighborhoods. You know, people were just coming out, walking down the street who had nothing to do with the protests, and they had to end up fighting. I felt like things could have been handled better to protect the most vulnerable people that were out there. And it showed me how much more we have to do. A lot of people want to claim Antifa, but that's an action. You know, it's an action. It's an actual action. And you can't just talk about it. It's not just, you know, an online, you know, identity. This is real life. It's street medics, and it's mutual aid. It's food, providing food and shelter, emergency shelter if need be. It's communications. It's self-defense. It's self-offense. You know, it's all of those things. And so they have to be coordinated. There was a time when we were in D.C. when we would have to fight and defend ourselves. There would be so many of the nonprofit groups or the larger known grassroots groups that were getting funding and were trying to be media darlings that would frown upon Antifa, that would frown upon anarchists, that would frown upon revolutionary socialists as we were out there, you know, black blocking and doing what we needed to do. And they felt as if we were causing the problem and they were trying to police us. You know, this summer, this spring, it really changed a lot of things. And the violence stepped up from the state as well as people's reactions to these fash. People were, you know, really handling what they needed to handle. So I think people, after seeing what happened and how many of these guys have been doing, you know, militia rallies at courthouses and at states around the country, brandishing their weapons, showing you, especially in Virginia. I took notice of that, especially because I'm from Virginia. And a lot of the people that are getting arrested are from Virginia and Maryland right at this moment, or adjacent to, you know, Washington, D.C. So this region that I'm in, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, it is the Confederacy. I'm from the Confederacy. And we have got to act like, we've got to fucking act like it. We've got to act like we're in a threat. And not just when they march through our towns in those formations, but every day. You see, it was judges and lawyers and military people and police officers. It's probably teachers and accountants. White supremacy is embedded into the United States of America. White nationalists are embedded into the United States of America. So these formations alone, these militia groups, they're not just the only ones we're fighting. We're fighting. We have to fight and protect and defend against all of the things that come against us. You know, and that's just an everyday thing. And if you live in Washington, D.C., that same mayor who wants to take credit for so many things has been not giving a damn. You know, Muriel Bowser hasn't given a damn about making sure that the Metropolitan Police Department, you know, aren't killing people and aren't, you know, pretty much their jump out squads were another way of stop and frisk. What I'm trying to say is the people of D.C. were terrorized before Proud Boys walked through the streets. We already have to battle with landlords and subpar housing and gentrification. And we've already lost like 20-30% of the black population that has been pushed out and or incarcerated after the 80s crime bills, after the 90s crime bills, the crime bills of the Republicans and the Democrats. People in D.C., Maryland, Virginia just been fighting against this state and then have to fight in the streets. It's too much. We're going to have to get some more troops, some more support. People are going to have to step it up to meet the threat that we're constantly surrounded by and not just look at it as these one-time events when, quote unquote, fash come to town. The town is fash every single day. So I just think people have to step it up. The threat that we're up against in this country is serious. And we can't just keep laughing at these people and making memes. They've exposed who they are in a way that they haven't in a long time. And yeah, they're getting a clapback, but over 70 million plus people voted for Trump. Do the damn math. Just do the math.
As people fighting back against both insurgent fascist groups and the state, we exist in a three-way fight where there is no place for the old military adage, "The enemy of my enemy is my ally." As terrifying as it is to see nearly every white supremacist faction across the United States form up into a hybrid mob, the instinct to seek refuge in alliances with state intelligence and police is doomed to fail and ultimately create the conditions of our own further oppression. Case in point, all the legislation Joe Biden has brought forward in response to the Capitol Hill ordeal is also primed and ready to be used against Antifa, members of Black liberation struggles, and the militant left more broadly. Such realities mean that anti-fascist movements, which are historically inclined towards a unified popular front, need to mature in our analysis and do the hard work to avoid making short-sighted alliances with our enemies.
For one thing, we have what we're dealing with right now is leftists and the left and this type of confusion of you know, what is or what isn't, and progressive, and, you know, everybody gets thrown into this one pan, and that's just not even a realistic, you know. I understand why people wanted to get Trump out of office and through some efforts behind getting Biden elected. But those of us, again, who, you know, I grew up in the crack era. I am a veteran of the war on, they called it the war on drugs, but it was the war on us. And that crime bill that Biden helped formulate, just like the Patriot Act that Biden helped formulate, I'm telling you, I don't think people even fully understand the goddamn devastation that unleashed upon us, you know, and the militarization that came in through our communities. This is when police started getting tanks and battering rams and just all kinds of ridiculous body armor and using it against Black brown people. It just to forget that and start backing, you know, even the so-called resistance or whatever they call themselves, you know, these progressives who are kind of wishy-washy and, you know, they don't want to go fully. I mean, I'm an anarcho-communist, so, you know, don't play around with me when it comes to the semantics game, you know, of what a socialist is or isn't. I know that comrades are democratic socialists, but I'm sorry, that doesn't go full enough for me, you know, for what we need. And often those people who identify as democratic socialists who are, you know, in the Democratic Party, they back down from every damn thing that even, you know, they should have been pushing for as the bare minimum. And you know, AOC and so many others, like, they'll say one thing and then do another thing. They'll say one thing and then they're not standing up against, you know, atrocities happening to Palestinians in Israel, or, you know, they're co-signing this bill or that bill that is going to help destroy, you know, the everyday average working person, including this damn stimulus. I mean, I really can't understand how other countries had money coming in on a regular monthly basis, and the United States barely gave, you know, pennies, tossed, you know, cake like they were Marie Antoinette. And then you have the leftists, you know, getting involved in this, and even those who weren't, trying to have a front with, let's say, anarchists and socialist groups, you know, trying to find a way to get out of their own egos, and some not really doing that well at all. Very loose base formations, very not trusting each other formations. And it needs to be tightened up overall. Like, I'm proud that people resisted so hard during the spring and the summer, in a time that we've never had before, with a pandemic raging, making it even hard to, for us to have physical contact and do the things that we normally would do, making it even hard to meet and build. I understand that. We're going to have to find a way around that, though, and we're going to have to get out of our own ideological bags that gives us these, superiority complexes that we can't work with this person and that person. Popular front. I don't see a real popular front. I see people coming together like a wave and then dissipating. And so some might say, well, aren't you an anarchist? I mean, but we believe in structures and organization, though. You know, we can't have a real movement. And I just see people every here and now and then. The type of order that we need to be able to wage a serious anti-fascist front, in a front that's not just about how we protect or battle against white supremacy and capitalism, but also how we build up our affection and our love and our camaraderie amongst each other. I always come back to that. That is just as important. Comrades can't trust each other, and we don't trust the state. So then wherein does that leave us? You know, when certain people have to always be at the forefront, you know, the cis heteropatriarchy, white people, you know, who have been at the forefront for so long. This movement that we are in 2021, it cannot look like it has in the past. The critiques of the white leftists, from Black, Brown, Indigenous people, from queer, from trans, gender nonconforming, non-binary people, has to be listened to. Certain people have been centering themselves for so long. It can't go on that way. If we're going to be serious about an abolitionist movement, a revolutionary autonomous movement, for Indigenous people to get land back. I just think that we really should be having more cohesion and understanding, and that some people who have been at the forefront need to step the fuck back, and it's time for others to come forward. And some were already out there and they're just not being listened to and supported. And in particular, I'll say again, queer, trans, gender nonconforming people. We're not being listened to and we're not being supported and centered for the marginalization and the oppression that we're dealing with. Disabled people are not centered. People with mood disorders and you know, neurodivergence are not centered. The matriarchy is not centered. We could just go on and on, but there needs to be a shifting within our circles, within our movements, within our popular fronts, for us to be able to fully address what the state and the citizens of the nation states, the white supremacist nation states, are doing to us on a global basis. And what I've seen all spring and summer is people starting to address that even more and being louder about that. Across the country, Black, Brown, Indigenous people, queer, trans, gender nonconforming people, we're making ourselves heard, and we need more support. If this is about ending colonialism, then shouldn't we be putting the people who are most marginalized and colonized to the forefront? That's just where I am with it for myself. After years of organizing, I see sometimes it seems things are changing and sometimes it seems it's just the same old shit and the same old people patting themselves on the back when they're really just standing on a platform of white privilege and cis heteropatriarchy, centering. It's kind of how we got into this shit in the first place. I don't know what makes people think we're going to get out of white supremacist capitalism by more white supremacist capitalism, how are we going to get out of neoliberal control by dealing with and catering to and pacifying the fucking neoliberals, you know? And it's obvious that people don't want to deal with the right wing and conservatives, and, you know, that's obvious, but all of the other microaggressions that people have and the lesser evils and settling, like, we can't do that shit. We can't. Again, we're not working with the feds. We're not cheering on the police. We can negotiate with these politicians. you know, especially those who are local. And even if we ran our own candidates, but honestly, I don't give a damn about running candidates and things of that nature. But if comrades are going to do it, then do it. But let's stop propping up these fucking establishment fucking politicians who don't give a damn about us and break their lies and, you know, break their truths every time and reveal that they're lies. Like Biden is already doing right now with the student loans and now with the stimulus. Like, they're always going to lie because they're capitalists. They're the elite. They're rich and they don't really give a damn about us. They just, you know, they use their position for their power. And we're going to have to understand that and get over our own shit and build up our own dual power right here and right now. We build up our power in our communities through our co-ops, our collectives, our mutual aid, and our taking care of what we need to take care of. And so that we can stand firm against the attacks of the state, because just because they're coming at these damn right wing people right now, they haven't forgotten about us. All our comrades got court cases coming up. Nothing stopped. People are still in the fucking prisons packed with COVID. Nothing stopped. People are still getting evicted. You know, we need a strong front that's serious about this and has the marginalized people first.
Recent years have seen the growth and spread of Black anarchism in the United States. This is an incredibly important development in terms of forging a new organic and revolutionary politics. It also represents a fundamental intervention into predominantly white anarchist scenes and the racist conditions that still thrive amidst our oh-so-good intentions. We asked Sima for her take on this momentum, and also to speak to the history of American Black liberation movements, as well as the Pan-African socialist tradition, and the ways these tendencies can inform and be informed by anarchism today.
Most Black anarchists I know are not practicing traditional white anarchism. And most Black socialists and Pan-African socialists that I know are not practicing traditional Eurocentric socialism. It doesn't even make sense that we're, you know, it just doesn't make sense that we would. Learning and taking lessons from things that are sort of a universalist, imperialist, anti-capitalist stance makes sense. But when it comes to the fact that we're dealing with a racialized classism and not just this I don't see color classism that so many people like to do when they don't want to acknowledge that they are settlers and or settler descendants, which is the same thing to me. It formulates how we approach anarchism. And Pan-African socialist movements have influenced many anarchists, mainly because they took lessons from, obviously, European, you know, Marxist and Leninist and so on and so forth, and adapted it to our unique, the oppression that was upon us, our unique situation. So for myself, studying Kropotkin, studying Emma Goldman, it always felt like there was something lacking in the analysis, and mainly it was race and how the oppression that affected them hit us in a totally different way. And that was the strength for me of Black anarchism and why it had a pull. And when I read the essays from Lorenzo Kumbor Irvin and would read Kwesi Balogun or Ashanti Alston, Sam Mba and others, it made more sense. It made more practical sense. And to many Black anarchists, also Afro-pessimism. And so when we reached the limit with Pan-African socialism that couldn't grasp the anti-state nature or the decentralization that we felt was a better methodology. Black anarchism kind of formulated itself to be able to address all of those things. What was lacking in European-centered socialism, what was lacking in Pan-African socialism, and what was lacking in European-centered anarchism. And so they kind of all go together. Inspiration from the Maroons and, you know, how they created community, again, which I always say is would look like dual power, what we call today dual power, but creating community away from your actual homeland, which is now your new homeland. Many of us even becoming wedded and having offsprings with the indigenous people who were here. So now we're Black, we're Afro-Indigenous, we're many things. And we're trying to create a community outside of the white supremacist state. As a Black anarchist, I feel like that's what we're always doing. As Pan-African socialists, that's what we're doing. We're trying to create a reality based upon our lived experience in the middle of white supremacy. I honestly think that many socialists and anarchists that are white realize that they're racist, or that they center themselves, or that they're still on a platform, or that they're really just being baby soft towards everyday white supremacy, because they go to protests and they think that that's all that they have to do. And we have a whole structure that is built in their image and has to be dismantled in any way, shape, or form. And I think about, comrades of the past who were anarchists or who were socialists who had to take those steps and step off of the platform of centering, step off of the platform of white privilege, and do and go above and beyond. You know, Comrade David and Comrade Marilyn Buck are two people that come to mind, and Laura Whitehorn, and it's just so many people, you know, from the Weather Underground and other organizations, people who work with the Black Liberation Army. I think John Brown is talked about way too much, and the people who work with him are talked about way too little. But Black anarchism, has always found ourselves trying to define what our liberation stance looks like in the middle of, traditions that are, again, usually catering towards whiteness. Our goal is not to sit and have to constantly teach white people that, you know, you're going to have to step the fuck back. But it does happen that we have to constantly have to do this when you have meetings, when you have cultural gatherings, just seeing people not understand and crossing lines and not respecting our traditions. And how we are defining and redefining what liberation looks like to us, whether that's the Republic of New Africa or, you know, whatever, whether it's the Anacatas, you know, whether it's a Maroon movement, whether it's a bridging of the elders with the new, such as the new Black Autonomy podcast that we have with Lorenzo Cambor Irvin and Jonina Irvin. With William C. Anderson helping to bring that about is a beautiful merging, of elders and new Black anarchists, Comrade Zoe, and so many others. We're making our voices heard and letting people feel more comfortable embracing anarchism, because quite often it doesn't center us. It doesn't even resonate, and it doesn't even remotely think about race in its connection to capitalism, as it should. And so Black anarchism frees us from those centralized structures, you know, that hierarchical structure, and opens it up for us to have more possibilities, I feel. And so it's beautiful to see. I see Black anarchism growing in a way that I have never in my entire life. And it has been boggling my mind to see articles and groups pop up all over the place doing mutual aid, fighting back in the streets, Black blocking. It's beautiful. And I hope it keeps growing, and I hope we keep getting free and keep defining what liberation looks like for us, and not to have it be defined by anyone else. It doesn't have to look like what someone else is doing. And it's beautiful to see.
Circle A is a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts. If you like this show, be sure to check out channelzeronetwork.com for a bunch more awesome content.
Ransom notes. It is a revolutionary. anarchist and anti-authoritarian music podcast.
That's going to come out every month.
Ransom what?
So what's like, I mean, what's your like ultimate goal, I guess, in this?
Yeah. Yeah, for the
rising up against the oppressor.
The attitude that you see in hip-hop.
Let me give you a sample of some of the lyrics that had some of the older ladies among the stockholders quite with dismay.
Good ransom notes. Hi.libsyn.com.
Or get them from the Channel Zero Network.
And now we're going to jump right back into our interview with Sima Lee. Next up, we asked for her insight on any potential political opportunities that exist now that far-right factions such as QAnon and their ilk are finding themselves more disenfranchised from mainstream political representation. Unfortunately, though unsurprisingly, we'll find out that any such opportunities are few, far between, and greatly outweighed by the white supremacy that is already hard-coded into America's established political structures.
Well, I mean, you know, I come from an area where the FBI and other groups have always, well, first off, I come from an area where white supremacist groups were actually notoriously Democrat. they were Democrats. They were Dixiecrats, you know, and bombings and shit like that, and lynchings, you know, those were happening, you know, all through the 90s, you know. If you fast forward to now, of course, like the demographic seems to have shifted a little bit more to the right now. But I don't really see a splintering as opposed to there's always been different styles of white supremacy. And so the state is, yeah, right now, because rich people were disturbed and because, you know, the Capitol itself was breached. And because politicians who were in the Capitol helped to do it, and Capitol police who were outside helped, and the police officers helped, and military former and not helped, you know, it just exposes that there are different types of white capitalist supremacy, you know, and they've historically had beef. I mean, didn't we have this little thing called the Civil War? They've had their differences. That shit never has benefited Black, Brown, Indigenous people, though. So I can't get too excited when the oppressor is having squabbles amongst each other, when we always end up with the blowback. In fact, when they splinter like this, it just, you know, it tends to be a big patriotic push, and they start to shut down things that are actually beneficial to, again, us, the resistance. So I'm actually kind of nervous right now with this squabble, because I'm waiting to see what's going to happen to us. They will go against the white supremacist groups. The white supremacist groups will go against the white supremacist groups. That's what I'm saying. It sounds foolish to say. I'm talking about the FBI going against these groups when the FBI, to us, you know, those of us who come from Black Panther backgrounds and Black Liberation Movement backgrounds, the feds, the FBI is one of the worst groups, you know, that has ever existed since the days of Hoover. It has never been for Black liberation, starting with deporting Marcus Garvey and their attack against all liberation movements, and AIM and the Young Lords and the Brown Berets, and setting them up in conjunction with the police. There were white supremacists doing operations then too, and the FBI would go against them too at the same time. But what we saw overwhelmingly since those days up until now is that they've always gone harder against us. They've always gone harder against the anarchists, if we take it back just 20 years, if we go to 1920 on up, you know, like look at how they went against the anarchists. There was white supremacy and race riots going on then. Their concentration was on the anarchists, though, and the socialist movement, though, and you know, nationalist movements like Garvey and so on and so forth, just like in the 60s, just like now. So when white supremacists are fighting each other, regardless of their set, you know, their blues and the reds and I'm this, I'm that, we just sit back and we watch to see which way the splinters are going to fall so we dodge and get out the way. And we continue to organize. I'm always extra cautious in a time like this. That's all.
Across Sima's work, she consistently frames the struggle for Black liberation within a revolutionary anti-colonial tradition, drawing particularly on the history of Maroon communities across Turtle Island. In this next segment, she speaks to how this history informs her politics and to the tensions that exist between this kind of analytical framework and the more so-called respectable liberal politics of inclusion, equality, and civil rights.
Again, for the Black liberation movement, and definitely for Black anarchists, the Maroons are a powerful symbol of autonomy and freedom and of utilizing our small numbers with guerrilla tactics against a much larger, oppressor as far as mass and numbers, but still being able to have community. North America, South America, Central America, the Caribbean, it's just so many places had rebellions, insurgencies, revolution. Cuba, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Belize, Florida, Louisiana, North Carolina, Virginia, Brazil, you had Palmares, you had actually the largest amount of Africans outside of Africa, the largest in the diaspora, was in Brazil and Palmares, and you had just huge, thousands and thousands of Maroons, creating a community, it's just amazing to even think. You had Mexico, like we don't even realize how people would escape into Mexico from the United States. And also there were Africans already in Mexico who were doing their own rebellions and were escaping and creating communities and became actually heads of communities and major parts of the history of Mexico. Gaspar Yanga and so on and so forth. The Garifuna in Honduras. So much of what the Maroons did was a merger of understanding the land and the environment and using it against the oppressor, and learning the herbs and learning the language of indigenous groups and tribes and uniting with them and against, again, a larger enemy that had taken over the land. We are in a very specific situation as Black people in the United States of America. We were taken from our traditional indigenous lands and put into another land of people who were also indigenous and being attacked. And so we've had to learn how to adapt and survive. We aren't settlers. We aren't colonizers. We are still the kidnapped, the push out, and trying to have a sense of autonomy and self, self-identification, self-worth, self-determination. And the Maroon is a representation of all of that. To me, they were the ultimate anarchists. And we gained so much inspiration from them because they had very little, but were still able to do amazing things, where whole sections to this day exist in different countries that are all Maroon descendants and still that land is connected to the Maroons. And it isn't taught enough, we don't learn enough about the Quilombos and the Palenqueros and we don't learn enough about how Afro-Indigenous people came to be in the Americas and why there are so many Afro-Indigenous people and our traditions of resistance. And for me, it makes more sense to look at the history of the Maroons and study that than to learn about some, what am I going to study? George Washington? Like, there were slave owners, I was force fed those histories as a youth in Virginia. The things that we had to go see, from the Jamestown plantations and slavery reenactments to the because I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, you know, MacArthur, George Douglas MacArthur's, you know, like homage to him, a whole museum showing up this horrible colonizer and, you know, honoring him and just, you know, really gross and having to honor Confederate statues and learning Confederate history. But we were never taught about the Maroons and about slave rebellions and about really how, you know, the Atlantic slave trade basically, and this whole thing that we're dealing with now that hasn't been resolved, heavily started in Virginia and directly where I was at, not just the state, but directly where we were at, Norfolk, Hampton, you know, Point Comfort, and so on and so forth. So that is my actual history. It isn't just, oh, I feel an inspiration from it. That is my actual history. And for so many people in the South, Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, that is their actual history. For so many Puerto Ricans and Jamaicans and Haitians and Dominicans and people from Honduras and Nicaragua, Guatemala, but Belize, Haiti, that is our actual history. So we have a history of autonomy and resistance that we can pull from and learn how to adapt that to the situations that we're in right here and right now. We can do some of the things that they did. We could do some things that they couldn't do. And it's our job to study all of that and create autonomy right here and right now, because I don't think some of us can take another minute more of this oppression. It's just, it invades every facet of our life. And our slavery is different than the slavery that they had. But the state is more advanced than it ever was back then. And so we have to learn and adapt. Learn from them and adapt to the times that we're in right now as modern day Maroons trying to escape this. But what better teachers could we possibly have? You know, we're still here because of them and because of their bravery. And I wish more people would study them, to be honest. And I think we'll be making sure that more people know about Maroons in 2021. I know I will.
Despite the almost cliche factionalism that can exist between anarchist tendencies, the past year under COVID has taught us that whatever color we add to our black flags, as anarchists, if we're not prioritizing mutual aid, we're letting down ourselves, our political communities, and the people who are most vulnerable in such times. If we leave the development of our mutual aid networks and skills until there is a crisis, we end up operating at a huge disadvantage and risk passing the buck to social services and NGOs, which have neither the capacity nor the mandate to do what is necessary.
For us, mutual aid is, as we learned from the Panthers, it's survival pending revolution. I come from working class, poor black people, and there's no shame in saying that, because this is something put upon us, you know, by the state. You know, the Reagan era. There's a show out right now about crack on Netflix. It just came out, and I highly recommend, you know, that people watch this documentary so you can really understand the dynamics starting with 1980 up and Ronald Reagan and the oppression and the welfare state that was created and the hunger and the lack of resources, lack of food, lack of clothing, lack of shelter. And then in addition to that, the government dumping crack on us and creating an underground economy that was backed by blood and guns and the police coming down on us and being a huge major part of it. The government coming down on us and being the forerunners of the program, and the even down to the Coast Guard and you know, Air Force flying the drugs. And what the 80s and 90s taught me is that the state will let you starve. Reagan will let you starve. Bush will let you starve. Clinton will let you starve. Like, that's what I learned from an early age. And so since the 80s and 90s, in my own communities, I've watched people come together and give mutual aid. And then I would learn later on that these were things that Black people had been doing since slavery, to make sure benefit, mutual benefit communities, mutual benefit organizations, funds that they would raise to take care of each other. Because who's going to do it for us? We learned early on that the state and was not going to look out for our better interests. And it was either we took care of each other with mutual aid or we would have died. We would have died. And we were so compassionate, I don't know why, that we even helped and shared some of our food and mutual aid with people who, you know, didn't give a fuck about us. And we didn't let them die either, you know, as always, looking out, you know, being compassionate. But it's just, it's that same compassion and looking out for each other from the past that we need now in the middle of this pandemic. People, unfortunately, a lot of the mass amounts of food that we've been getting, that we've been seeing from city to city, state to state, have come from places like Amazon. You know, being a huge donor. And so people who are, you know, a company that has made billions and has been exploiting people and, you know, during this pandemic is actually been, you know, trying to get good, you know, good favor and good press write-ups by giving, you know, food at the same time. Who we get our food from, you know, who we get our items from, how we get it through the supply and demand of it, is something that we're going to have to look at with our mutual aid. A lot of the toiletries and PPE that a lot of people get in mass comes also through Amazon. And so, you know, we're looking for ways to have Black, Brown, Indigenous companies make their own, you know, sanitizers and, you know, masks. And like, clearly we need those things. You know, clearly we need those things. Clearly we need our own factories. And, you know, this hunger isn't going to go away anytime soon. The jobs aren't going to pop open tomorrow. Everything that we took for granted or got used to or thought would always be around, even if we were barely making it and sustaining ourselves then, those things are falling apart too. So more than ever, we need to establish more mutual aid for the year of 2021, probably even more so than last year, as the infection of corona is mutating and making itself even more so that people can be, you know, harmed by it. Entire families have been devastated. People who were the breadwinners have passed. We have to look out for each other. I mean, I say it all the time. If you know me, that's one of my favorite phrases. We have to look out for each other. We cannot let this state harden us and take it for granted that everybody has food. You know, I see sometimes comrades get into conversations and they, you know, they start talking about things and, you know, it's no knock against them, but some of the things they're talking about isn't even in the scope of people who don't know where they're going to sleep that night. Or what they're going to eat. And so one of the things we do definitely is try to make sure we not just give people food and PPE, but sometimes just give people money. People need money. Until we eradicate the use of money, people need funds. That's where the GoFundMes come in and the creative ways to raise money and, you know, concerts, online concerts and whatever it is. People who have the funds should be giving it to the community. We know that the state is not going to look out for us and we can't keep waiting and sitting and praying and hoping. We have to take action and not just wait to, you know, order food, but grow our own food, build our own structures, you know, take over buildings, do what we need to do to provide for each other. That is the core of what we do. That is the core of what the Maroons had to do. That is the core of what we do. And there's not going to be any real liberation movement that says that it's for the working class that isn't making sure that people have food and a place to stay. And any movement that claims to be a liberation movement that doesn't do that, I feel you're exploiting people. I've gone to marches and protests and went back hungry. And I wanted to make sure people never had to go through that, anyone who was around me. And so that has always been the core of what pushes me having grown up in that, in poverty, and people treating you as if you're less than, as opposed to you're someone fighting against the state, and poverty could be a result of it, you know. So mutual aid is huge for the anarchists, for the socialists, for the revolutionaries, and it should be the core of what we do, to make sure that our comrades live to not just make sure our comrades make it, you know. I could go on and on, but I don't want to go on too further. But comrades are hungry.
To end things off, we couldn't pass up the chance to nerd out with another member of the Channel Zero Network about podcasts, and specifically Sima's new show, which, in case it wasn't clear, you should definitely go check out.
The Maroon Cast. Yeah, Maroon Cast is a project that we just dropped for the past couple months. It's been getting a lot of good feedback from comrades. It's really, I don't do a lot of interviews. I don't do a lot of videos. I don't even do a lot of performances. Rest in peace to MF Doom, but I understand that reclusive thing, you know, as an artist, you kind of just wanting to just present the art and not be so much in the forefront. But there are views and things that in this time people have been wanting to hear more of me speaking on and talking about and analyzing and, you know, sharing, you know, experience from 30 plus years of organizing as an anti-racist, anti-fascist, you know, queer, transgender, non-conforming, fuck shit up type of person. So I figured, why not do a podcast so that I can do that, bridge the gaps, good medium, good way to give political education, have fun, and teach. And it just so happens that when we dropped it, you know, it dropped, even though I was thinking about doing it beforehand, I didn't get to a real chance to be able to until now during this pandemic, when everybody's listening to podcasts and everyone's doing things online. And so I guess the timing is really good. People have more time to listen and hear what we're talking about as far as our organizing, our local organizing and Maroon movement and our on the ground work with mutual aid and, you know, our analysis with our comrades and so on and so forth. But also just our analysis of what's going on nationally and globally in the liberation movements of so many. And it's a powerful time right now. I should be writing some books too, but, you know, the podcast is at least a good way for me to offer information that people can take with them and they can last with them. And I know it was important for me to be able to have people to listen to that had alternative views to what the, you know, mainstream liberalized views were. And I just want to provide that for others who are looking for that same thing. It's very important to have. And people tell me they're working out listening to Maroon Cast, you know, and you know, driving listening to Maroon Cast. And that makes me feel good. People, you know, it's an international thing, and that makes me feel good, and have hopefully helped to connect me to some other comrades who've been also doing podcasts. Well, obviously so, because now we're on Channel Zero Network with you all. And so we're even, those are comrades that we've been listening to on Channel Zero Network for a very long time. So it was awesome to be able to be a part of a decentralized group of anarchists and anti-state folks dropping these gems on people. And yeah, it's the new soapbox. The podcast is the new soapbox to be able to talk and spark this revolution that we're all trying. And I'm loving it. We're going to expand it to a live IG, Twitch, Facebook Live portion. That I call Beats, Blunts, and Revolution, where we're going to incorporate a little hip hop, a little cannabis, cannabis advocacy, which a lot of people also know me for, in addition to analysis, so that we can, you know, kind of relax it, show a little videos, have some performances, spice it up, mix it up, Just trying to keep it real fly in 2021.
And that's where we'll leave it. In addition to subscribing to MaroonCast, head to sub.media/trouble and check out Trouble number 15, Hip Hop as Resistance, where we feature music and interviews with Sima Lee and other anarchist MCs. Submedia is entirely funded by our viewers and listeners, so if you're in a position to help out, visit sub.media/donate or pick up some of our merch at sub.media/gear. If money's tight but you still want to support the show, consider leaving a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice, as well as telling a friend or two about why you listen to Circle A.
Thank you for listening. Goodbye.